Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Yesterday at the state capitol, Oklahoma Governor Mary Fallon provided her recommendations to the legislature on how to fill next year's estimated $1.3 billion budget hole. Her budget 2.0 provides for exempting Common Education, the Oklahoma Health Care Authority, and mental health services in the state from cuts. There are cuts in other areas, including higher education, but the plan also offers significant revenue enhancements to the budget as well. Joining us today is economist and policy analyst David Blatt, the executive director of the Oklahoma Policy Institute, to discuss the governor's plan and also to discuss the Medicaid Rebalancing Act, which will allow the Oklahoma Health Care Authority to use the Medicaid expansion funds to help Oklahoma's low-income uninsured. David Blatt, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Always a pleasure.
We invited you on to talk about the Oklahoma Health Care Authority's Medicaid Rebalancing Act, and we'll certainly talk about that, but events yesterday afternoon sort of superseded that conversation in which teachers went to the Capitol en masse to file for legislative office on the first day of the filing period for state offices, and Governor Mary Fallon announced her, I believe it's Executive Budget 2.0,
right.
her recommendations for filling the $1.3 billion shortfall. And there were some really interesting things on how to balance the budget without just draconian cuts. What was the most impressive thing to you from that?
To me, the fact that the governor was out there in the middle of April with a follow-up budget, something that I haven't seen in the 20 years or so that I've been involved in state budget. Usually the governor puts forward a plan at the very beginning of session and then is involved behind the scenes in negotiations with House and Senate leadership. But this is the first time the governor has ever come back with a second budget proposal. The governor now felt it was important enough to make sure, I think, first of all, that people recognize that she's still part of the process and has an important voice and ultimately does have the possibility of a veto if the budget is something that she's not willing to accept. But what was as important as the fact that she came out with a revised 2.0 budget was the specifics of it. As you know, and as most of your listeners know, we have this massive budget shortfall, $1.3 billion less certified revenue for next year's budget than what was initially appropriated this year. And of course, there are tremendous fears about the cuts that may ensue, whether it is to teaching positions and school days in our public school system, whether it's to healthcare providers, reimbursement rates and benefits, which could lead to really grave limits on access to care for Medicaid patients. You can go across the board. There is real concern about what this budget hole means. What the governor did in her budget was say there are revenue options out there. She put forward a series of proposals, some of which were recycled from her initial budget, some of which were new or somewhat different. But she came up with over $1 billion, I think $1.2 billion in revenue ideas, enough so that in her 2.0 budget, the Department of Education would not be cut compared to where they were at the beginning of this year. They would see this year's mid-year cuts restored. The Medicaid agency would not be cut. The Department of Human Services and Mental Health and Corrections and several others would not be cut. So she's sending a clear message to legislators and to the public. We have options here. There are things we can do to avert this disaster that is looming.
Let me ask you, those were unveiled as additions to the budget, but in reality, what it means is that the actual dollar number will be what was appropriate at the beginning of this current year, but has been cut
right
through the mid-year rescissions.
So just to review, we started the year, we're in the FY 2016 budget year, and they're working on the budget now for 2017. As a result of revenues coming in below projections, we had two successive mid-year revenue failures, and agencies were cut by 3% and then by 4%. So a total of 7% from their initial 2016 budgets, they had that 7% cut. Then the legislature went in, tapped the rainy day fund to make up, restore some of that cut for education and corrections. But education is still down from where they were at the beginning of 2016. What the governor is now proposing with her new budget is to restore education, Medicaid, mental health, corrections back to where they were at the beginning of 2016. So they're calling that an increase, but it's really more of a flat budget compared to where they were at the beginning of the year. But that is significant because if you've been listening to what we've heard from superintendents and hospital administrators and mental health providers, there is tremendous fear out there of major cuts. The Oklahoma Healthcare Authority, the state's Medicaid agency, is moving ahead with implementing what could be a 25% cut in Medicaid reimbursement rates on June 1st. Now, June 1st is the day after session is supposed to end. So what they're saying is if the legislature comes in with additional money, they won't do 25% cuts. If the legislature doesn't do that, then this is what we're facing. So under the governor's plan, the 25% cuts would be averted. There still might need to be some cuts.
What would the impact of 25% cuts be for the poor seeking medical treatment?
It would be devastating.
Doctors Medicaid, just probably wouldn't see them?
We had the State Medical Association saying that they were going to recommend to their members to consider not accepting patients, not accepting Medicaid patients. You have to understand, Medicaid covers about 800,000 people in the state. It is the major provider of health care for children and pregnant women, but also for frail seniors in nursing homes or receiving services at home or in the community for individuals with disabilities. It is not a major insurer for working age adults, but for those other populations. So in many areas, for hospitals, for nursing homes, for home health providers, for durable medical equipment providers, mental health providers, their business is very closely tied to Medicaid. We've had cuts over the last couple of years. Medicaid paid almost the full rate of Medicare. We're now down to about 86.5%. This would be 25% on top of those cuts that have already happened. If Medicaid is only paying 60%, 65%, 68% of what Medicare is paying, it is not viable for a lot of providers. So we are seeing the Nursing Home Association saying that 93% of nursing home facilities would not survive this. We're already seeing the struggles that rural hospitals are having. This would be devastating for hospitals that do a lot of deliveries. Medicaid pays for most deliveries in the state. So I think the message is getting out there that we can't absorb those kinds of cuts without it having a devastating impact, not just on the Medicaid system, but really on our whole healthcare infrastructure.
Well, let's talk to what Governor Fallon recommended. The biggest single piece was issuing bonds for the transportation projects. This, right, depending on how many bonds they issue, I've seen $400 to $500 million. I think you've suggested even at the Oklahoma Policy Institute it could be as much as $700 million. So is that just kicking the can down the road? Because we traditionally have not used – well, we've used bonds at times, but using bonds for year-to-year transportation infrastructure improvements, is that a good thing in the long term?
We certainly have used issued transportation bonds in the past, and it is infrastructure, and it certainly makes – some sense. The question is how much bonding to do, because there's a maximum of how much can be issued, the size of the bonds that can be issued. This is really in the category of one-time revenue proposals. And one of the debates that we're now seeing is with this $1.3 billion shortfall, how much additional revenue can we scrounge together, and how much of that is going to be one time? And the governor at the beginning of session rightly said that we need to avoid filling the hole with a undue reliance on one-time funding. So in addition to transportation bonds, there's the rainy day fund. There is sweeping money out of agency revolving funds. There's the unclaimed property fund. There's a lot of things that could be done that would be more one time. But we've been doing that for years, and that doesn't solve the problem. It means that we're simply pushing things further. So there will have to be some one-time revenue options in the final budget, but there's also some strong and sensible recurring revenue options. And hopefully the pressure will be on the decision makers to avoid relying too heavily on one-time revenue fixes, such as these transportation bonds, and be sure to have recurring revenue that helps us dig out of this hole.
Now, some of the other revenue options were ending the double deduction for state income tax. That's something you've been talking about
many times. We've been talking about that one for years. That's a tax break that is really a quirk of the tax system that allows taxpayers who itemize their federal returns and get to deduct their state income tax on their federal returns. Oklahoma is one of very few states that allows taxpayers to then deduct their state income tax from their state income tax. The governor now has come out in favor of repealing that deduction. The Senate has been in favor of that, but they still haven't reached agreement. Apparently, the House is still not quite on board on this.
And that would raise about $87 million?
Somewhere between $85 and $100 million.
Yeah. Now, another one that she mentioned was increasing sales tax on some services. That list is very nebulous, but one big one was advertising and also on tickets for events. How much money could that raise by just broadening the sales tax in a lot of different areas where it's not currently being charged?
Yeah, there's a number of components of the sales tax debate. One of them is taxation from internet sales, which is being discussed, but very unclear as to what the revenue potential is on that and what the state legally can do. Another one is taxing services such as haircuts and auto repair maintenance
services,
and other things.
Yeah.
What the governor actually proposed yesterday was more doing away with some of the existing sales tax exemptions to the purchases of goods. And she does talk about advertising sales. She talks about sales of horses. The one that is probably the most solid policy proposal, but will likely get some of her donors all upset, is to do away with the sales tax exemption for Oklahoma City Thunder basketball tickets. And I think we really have to – this is where you could see that the tax code is in many ways just involved various giveaways to different interests.
A lot of Swiss cheese and a lot of holes.
A lot of Swiss cheese. So in an effort to draw the Thunder to Oklahoma, they provided a sales tax exemption on Thunder tickets. So we have the situation in the state where if you buy a ticket to a luxury box at a Thunder game, if you're fortunate enough to be able to afford that, you don't pay sales tax, but on a loaf of bread, you do. Her proposal is to do away with that. There's about $100 million of sales tax exemptions. And I think it's a fair guess that the lobbyists will be on a full court press to explain why doing away with the sales tax exemption on sales of airplane parts and horses and advertising would be utterly ruinous to the state of Oklahoma.
Right, right. She also mentioned, did she mention anything about tax credits, some of the tax credits?
Very little. Tax credits are not a central part in her plan. She did talk about the earned income tax credit, which was one of three broad-based tax credits that is mostly help support low and moderate income families. Currently, the Oklahoma State Earned Income Tax Credit, or EITC, like the federal one, is refundable, which means you can, if you get a $40 state tax credit and that exceeds your income tax liability, you can still get that money back as a credit. It offsets some of the other taxes you pay. She proposed doing away with refundability of that. That would be about $30 million less money going to families that qualify for the EITC. There was an announcement the day before between the Senate Finance Chair and the House Appropriations Chair of a tax credit reform package. And that was about $200 million, and it sounds like the House and the Senate have agreement on that. But interestingly, that wasn't part of the governor's plan. So there's still maybe some conflict. The House and Senate, for the most part, they're talking about putting an annual cap on various credits, capping it, various credits at $5 million to $25 million. But the way they're going about it is saying that if you qualify for the credit and they've exceeded the cap, credits will accrue, but they won't. They'll be put in the queue and they'll be paid out later. This seems like just creating long-term liability for the state, but that does free up some short-term revenue. Ultimately, it's more on the line of this one-time budget balancing.
What would be a better approach?
You can do something where either it is first in, first
out,
or you can do some kind of proportional amount. So they're grappling with this. They haven't found a great solution by any means. And it's not clear at the end of the day how much tax credit reform there will be. It was also worth pointing out that in this House-Senate plan, that the one significant credit they would eliminate entirely is the child tax credit, which is claimed by 350,000 Oklahoma households. And this is, again, one which low-income, moderate-income households claim that credit, and they would be losing that tax credit. At the same time, there is still a refusal among the Republican leadership in the legislature and the governor to go back to this 0.25% income tax cut that took effect in January, which we were told was only supposed to take effect if revenues were growing, was never meant to take effect in the midst of revenue shortfalls and $1.3 billion budget crisis. And yet reversing that tax cut is a bridge too far. We're doing all these other things, twisting ourselves in knots and coming up with all these creative approaches when the most obvious one is staring them in the face and they just will not do it. This is $150 million, but it would also send an important signal that says that the income tax cut was a mistake because of the circumstances in which it was passed. All they need to say is when we passed it, we could not foresee what was going to happen to the energy sector. We could not foresee the shortfalls we were facing. We need to cancel it or at least suspend it. But instead, we're going ahead with a 0.25% income tax cut, which is disproportionate benefit to the highest income people, and we're going to cut the child tax credit.
My guest today is David Blatt, the executive director of the Oklahoma Policy Institute. We're talking about Governor Fallon's recommendations to fill the state budget deficit for the coming year. She had a press conference and announcement yesterday. At the same time, teachers were all filing into the Capitol to file for legislative office. And I have to ask you about the politics of this. Was this announcing this day in direct response to this sort of creation of the teachers' caucus for all these teachers that are filing for legislative office next year?
I think the timing was less than a pure coincidence. As a matter of fact, the teacher advocates had announced that they were going to meet at 4 o'clock on the second floor at the state election board to file together, and the governor's press conference began right at 4 o'clock. So some media who would have been talking to new teacher candidates were diverted to hear what the governor had to say. But I think stepping back a little bit, there has been a growing volume coming from parents, teachers, the broader education community about the crisis that is facing our schools with teacher shortages, with growing class sizes, with potential teacher layoffs, with the elimination of key programs and classes and optional programs like band and perhaps even some sports programs. And there is a level of frustration and outrage that is now being heard. And I think it's translating into more teachers and educators filing for office, more candidates trying to associate themselves as pro-education and in opposition to what the state's leadership has done over the last few years. And I think the governor really was signaling that she's heard that and she wants to do whatever possible although again, there are certain options that she's not considering, but is urging the legislature not to cut the education budget.
We mentioned that common education, healthcare authority, mental health services, corrections, they're looking at flat budgets. Most other agencies are looking at, what, 4.5%?
And that would be 4.5% on top of the 7% that they absorbed this year.
That includes higher education.
It does.
And also a loss of complete state appropriations to everything from the Attorney General's office to the insurance department where they can self-fund.
Right.
And there's some other agencies that are, it's unclear, at least to me, the tourism department and
Historical Society.
The Historical Society.
Yeah, they get some off-the-top allocations of tax revenues that go directly to them, and the governors would do away with that. There's a lot of details in that, which the governor recognized that this was a blueprint. Some of these ideas have been discussed by the legislature. Some haven't. Some won't be. What I think was significant and frankly helpful from what the governor did yesterday was to send out the clear message that cuts are not inevitable, that we've already squeezed hard on the budgets of school districts and mental health providers and health agencies and DHS. We've squeezed really tight, and that if we have to cut further, it's going to be really painful. We're going to do some irreparable harm to core services to the states and to the families and communities that depend on state government in all kinds of forms. So what she's trying to say is we can avoid that, and let's be open and creative about what the revenue options are.
In our last few minutes, we're going to talk about the Medicaid Rebalancing Act of 2020, which is the Oklahoma Healthcare Authority's bill to accept the federal dollars associated with Medicaid expansion, but we're not expanding Medicaid. In fact, we're contracting Medicaid, and we're moving more of those low-income individuals, as I understand it, to Insure Oklahoma, which is private-public partnership insurance. And it means it could mean that people who are receiving Medicaid will now have to start paying some sort of premium.
Right. So there's a number of components to the plan, which they're calling the Medicaid Rebalancing Act of 2020. This is unquestionably tied to the Affordable Care Act and to the efforts under the ACA to expand coverage to low-income working age adults, those with incomes at or below the federal poverty level, who under the ACA make too little to qualify for subsidies on the commercial exchanges. And because of the Supreme Court's ruling in 2012, states had the option of whether or not to expand coverage to that population. The federal government was going to pay 100% of that cost for the first 3 years, and then that phased down, but no less than 90% federal participation in perpetuity. I think right now we're at 97% or 95%. And Oklahoma is one of the states. Governor Fallon is one of the refusenik states that has said, no way, no way, no way, year after year. We're now in a situation where the crisis is serious enough that the governor and other leaders are changing their tone some. And what they're saying is, here's this plan that the Oklahoma Healthcare Authority has put forward that would expand coverage, but not through traditional Medicaid. It would take those newly eligible folks and enroll them in a variation of the existing Insure Oklahoma program, which you mentioned, a public-private partnership where we use state and federal dollars and some participation from the members themselves towards buying commercial health insurance. We developed this model 10, 12 years ago. Arkansas actually looked to Oklahoma and borrowed much of it for its expansion a couple of years ago.
And it has lowered uninsured rates.
Absolutely.
Indiana seems to have a similar plan, and they're also seeing, at this point, higher rates of use of this sort of hybrid.
So there are various components to what is being proposed by the healthcare authority. Some of them are based on the Arkansas model. Some are based on the Indiana model. We actually put up a blog post a couple of days ago on our blog at okpolicy.org that tried to set out what we know, which is, at this point, not a whole heck of a lot. The healthcare authority has put forward a two-page summary They have, in fact, tomorrow afternoon in Tulsa, they're going to have a public meeting for stakeholders, which the public is welcome to attend, where they're going to explain more. The big part, as you mentioned, is to make this coverage available to those who are currently ineligible through the Insure Oklahoma model. The second part of it, as you mentioned, is take part of the population that is currently covered by Medicaid, and that is children and pregnant women whose income is somewhere between 133% and 185% of the federal poverty level. So if it's a family of three, roughly if you make between $25,000 and $40,000 a year. What the healthcare authority is proposing, but not right away. Right now, states cannot restrict their Medicaid eligibility. What the healthcare authority is suggesting is that in 2019, when this federal maintenance of effort requirement is set to expire, that we would take that population currently in Medicaid and move them onto these federal exchanges where they would be eligible for subsidies. So two things happen here, if it's allowed. And I think there's a very big question about whether this would be allowed. And I have a real suspicion that it might not be allowed, that this maintenance of effort requirement would be extended further. Because basically what Oklahoma is doing is to say, hey, rather than us pay a portion of the share through Medicaid, pay a third of their costs, we're going to put them on the exchange and have the federal government assume 100% of the cost. Well, that's a good deal for Oklahoma. They said we could save $60 million a year. It's not a good deal for the federal government. And I think that if they see that states are looking to do this, that Congress may well say, if you want to continue to get various other benefits, we're going to have to maintain, extend that maintenance of effort requirement further. But that's what they're talking about, taking people from Medicaid and moving them onto the exchanges.
So will this save the state any money?
If it were to happen, it would save the state money.
How much do we know?
Well, they said $60 million. That's definitely a ballpark figure, but that's not inconsequential.
Okay. Will this system, if it works as they envision it, be as efficient as just expanding Medicaid?
Well, there's two parts. The straight Medicaid expansion is for the population that would be now moved into Insure Oklahoma. I would argue that this is more complicated, that it's more uncertain, that if we wanted to make it simplest and most cost-effective, we would just expand Medicaid. But the reality is that in Oklahoma, with a Republican governor and legislature, that a straight Medicaid expansion is not on the table. This hybrid approach seems to be more politically palatable. But here's what's so frustrating, Rich. What the healthcare authority proposed 2 months ago as the Medicaid Rebalancing Act of 2020 is almost identical to what the consultants who came in here in 2013, the Levitt report, commissioned by the healthcare authority and the governor, this is what they recommended 3 years ago. Move expanding coverage through Insure Oklahoma. It is 98% the same plan. We could have done this 3 years ago. We could have been providing coverage. We could have been shoring up rural hospitals and community health centers and others who've been struggling with the burden of uncompensated care. We waited and waited and waited because of political circumstances. And now everybody's saying, well, we can do this. It's still worth doing, and I think it's still better than what we have now. And in fact, you know, we probably have to do it now. But this was the stubbornness, the political thinking that led us to wait for 3 or 4 years was really tragic.
All right. Well, David Blatt, thank you very much for your time today. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on.
David Blatt is the executive director of the Oklahoma Policy Institute. You can learn more at okpolicy.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.